The partial government shutdown we just experienced reminds us of a face-off nearly 20 years ago between Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich. How do they compare? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In this News Buzz edition of the program, we look at the aftermath of the latest clash in Washington compared to what happened in the 90s, and look at how Iowa and national politics have changed since then. We'll talk with IPR correspondent Dean Bork and get analysis from Dennis Goldford of Drake University. Then it's on to the World Food Prize controversy this week with Clay Masters. Welcome back for more Iowa National Guard troops and the capture of Willie the Pig. Fasten your seatbelts for a News Buzz after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a Friday News Buzz edition of the program, a chance for quick conversations with a variety of people about news stories this week in Iowa or stories that we as Iowans are concerned about. And of course, the big news this week we're concerned about not only in Iowa, but the nation, the world, in fact, the end of the partial government shutdown. Now, there have been 17 government shutdowns since 1976. They've lasted an average of 5 days. But the one that truly stands out, next to the budget standoff that ended this week, occurred in December of 1995. It lasted 3 weeks. Joining me to recall that political drama, a journalist who was in the middle of covering Iowa news and politics then, as he is now, Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Bork. Hi, Dean.
Hello, Ben.
Remind us, take us back to 1995, December. Tell us what happened and how it happened. Who was in office?
Well, Bill Clinton's administration had just begun in 1993. And just a year or two after that, there was a strong Republican comeback in 1994, led by Newt Gingrich. And those who might be reminded, under the contract with America, if you remember that phrase, the Republicans nationally ran on the contract with America, promised to cut government regulation and the size of government spending. Does that sound familiar?
Yes.
And a struggle over the role of the federal government. Mm-hmm. And President Clinton vetoed the budget passed by the Republican Congress. Republicans came back in 1994, I should say, and really took over both the Senate and the House with good majorities. And so with the Republicans passing what they wanted in fiscal budget being vetoed by President Clinton, resulted in a standoff, and the government was shut down in November 1995 for 6 days, and then again in December 1995, just a month later, and that lasted a bit longer. Now, I might say, too, there is a parallel here, because as Bill Clinton took office, you recall, he attempted a complex health care reform.
Yes.
And that planning was under the direction of First Lady Hillary Clinton. It collapsed on its complexity and in controversy because it was being led by the First Lady.
Mm-hmm. So there are some eerie similarities here. Now, focus in on the Iowa delegation, because when we go back almost 20 years to that time, Iowa's congressional delegation looked much different, didn't it?
It was all Republican. In the first district, Jim Leach. Second district, Jim Nussel, who later then ran for governor of Iowa and was defeated. Jim Ross Lightfoot over in southwest Iowa. Greg Gansky had just defeated Neil Smith, who had been in Congress and the House of Representatives for 36 years at that time. Greg Gansky, a plastic surgeon from Des Moines, defeated Neil Smith. And then Tom Latham was new in the Congress at that time. So it was all Republican delegation. And, of course, Tom Harkin holding one senatorial seat and Chuck Grassley the other.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting when you go through those names, Jim Leach's name pops out as a moderate Republican who served for decades in a part of the state that is known as the most liberal part of the state. So what does that tell us about how our state politics have followed the national trend in terms of the moderates in the parties really disappearing?
And that's right. And Jim Leach, as you pointed out, was in a more moderate district. And so he reflected that in the Congress and lost his effectiveness there as a Republican in being a very moderate Republican because he was stripped of leadership roles in the Congress.
Mm-hmm. Also, we have seen in the intervening nearly two decades a change in the feeling in politics. Dean, this polarization, talk about that a little bit.
Well, it's interesting you'd mention Jim Leach because we had Jim Leach and Neil Smith on a statewide program just a week ago talking about that very thing and the polarization. And, of course, Neil Smith being Democrat and Jim Leach, Republican, moderate Republican that he was, serving both together in the House of Representatives, they both are decrying the increasing effect of money in political campaigns and the fact that money is resulting in the extreme, is a big factor in the big extreme in polarization in the Congress today, and also the tendency of people to move into districts that are more like them politically.
Mm-hmm. When we go back and do this comparison between 1995 and 2013, the two partial government shutdowns. In 1995, what repercussions did that have for elections that followed in the 90s?
I just don't see that there were that many repercussions. Leonard Boswell did take over the Southwest Iowa seat that had been held by Jim Ross Lightfoot. He came into the Congress in 1996, but that was an open seat, and he defeated Montezuma Republican Mike Mahaffey, who had been chaired the Iowa Republican Party. But that, I don't believe, was a backlash at all of the shutdown of the federal government. I don't think there was much effect. As much effect as we're seeing right now, of course, this is in the just after the heat of battle in Washington. But from what I'm monitoring and just casual conversations with people on the street and listening to radio call-in programs, a variety of those, there's a lot of anti-incumbent sentiment. And surprisingly, a lot of it being directed against Tom Latham in the Des Moines area and that southwest Iowa area that he now represents.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we remind ourselves, Senator Grassley and Congressman Steve King were the no votes on this. The GOP yes vote was Tom Latham, right?
That's right. And that is being threatening now, a primary, and that's unheard of with such a long-standing incumbent as Tom Latham. But right now the talk is of a primary, a Republican primary, that would try to take him out.
Mm. Dean, what about the effect of all this on Iowa's Republican Party?
Well, it's yet to be seen. You know that Iowa's Republican Party right now is controlled by those who are closely aligned with Ron Paul, the former Texas congressman, philosophically. They now control Iowa's Republican Party Central Committee. And you remember that just in recent weeks, Appanoose County Republican Central Committee, Polk Counties, Poweshiek, and Linn Counties, four major counties in Iowa have asked A.J. Spiker, the Republican state chair, to resign. Now, what is this going to do to the control that's being held by the ultra-conservatives in Iowa? And I think you might also say, what is this doing also to the reputation of the Iowa caucuses? And I think it could possibly have some fallout in both places.
Dean Borg, we can certainly say we'll track the aftermath of this latest battle in Washington. Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ben.
Joining us now to talk about the aftermath of the budget standoff, to continue with our conversation here on River to River, a News Buzz edition. Now that this partial government shutdown is over, let's get some analysis from Dennis Goldford, Drake University professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Ben. How are you?
Very good. You just heard our conversation there with Dean Borg. Let me get your view on the comparison of this shutdown with that infamous 1995 one.
Well, when Bill Clinton was elected president, Dick Armey was from Texas, who's now, at least he was, head of FreedomWorks, one of the big organizations helping to sponsor the Tea Party, although he left them with some dispute several months or a year or so ago. But he was the House Minority Leader and then the House Majority Leader under Newt Gingrich. And but when Bill Clinton was elected president, somebody interviewed him and he talked about our president, our new president, and Army basically spat back at him saying he's not my president, he's your president. So there was an anger and a bitterness then, or at least an early kind of polarization, but it was nothing like what we have now. We had that shutdown. The Gingrich people learned, despite being a strong speaker, that he and the Republicans in the House could not govern the country from the House. I think that's a lesson that some Republicans already knew this time around, but others haven't seemed to grasp that yet. John Boehner, somebody said recently, Republicans control one-third of the elected institutions in Washington, the House, as opposed to the Senate and the presidency. But there was fallout. Of course, Bill Clinton was successfully reelected in 1996, even though it was followed by the impeachment problem. But the major difference, I think, is that now, if anything, the parties, although some people and somebody, in fact, on Politics Wednesday called in and talked about these parties run everything, in fact, the parties' problem is not that they're too strong, they're too weak, because they can't control and discipline their individual members. The individual members, and John Boehner dealt with this all the time, have the capacity to reach out to alternative media outlets and especially alternative funding sources that gives them a certain independence of the party leadership. That's exacerbated the problem now and helped increase the vitriol and bitterness of the partisanship.
Now, President Obama declared after the end of this shutdown, there are no winners. A statement for public consumption, to be sure.
Sure.
President Obama, let's talk a little more in depth about the winners and losers. President Obama, the big winner here, right?
Well, you know, I heard the last year or two a bunch of Democrats saying, where's Lyndon Johnson when you need him? And, you know, Johnson was famous for basically bashing heads and knew what worked with particular members of Congress and getting them to go along with him, even if they didn't want to. And, you know, Barack Obama sort of floats above the fray. He seems to think that the arguments for his policies are self-evident, such that he doesn't actually have to persuade people. There's just an automatic logic to the rightness of his arguments.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of Democrats have complained that really he hasn't fought the Republicans and that he hasn't stood up to them. In particular, now in a way he has. This is why there were extra cries of anguish from Republicans, because when they would attack him, especially conservatives, they would attack him and go after him. They were outraged that he actually defended himself and fought back. So this has helped President Obama. Does it mean he can pass his agenda? He talked about the farm bill, immigration, and the budget in particular. No, it doesn't mean that, but at least he showed some spine as far as Democrats are concerned and to the outrage of Republicans.
Now, the appearance is that the spine he showed was being supported in large part by the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, the former boxer, the taciturn fighter. Do you see it that way?
Well, he certainly couldn't have done it without the Senate. But that's, you know, there's the, and I think I've said on Politics Wednesday at various times over the years, the old Will Rogers line, I'm not a member of any organized political party, I'm a Democrat. Well, you know, in this particular case, it was the Democrats that were organized and united, and it was the Republicans that were acting like, you know, chickens with their heads cut off, running all over the place. So President Obama could not, you're right, have done this without Harry Reid and the Democrats in the Senate. And so they've acted as a united functioning political party.
Mm-hmm. What is the fallout for House Speaker John Boehner? He says he fought the good fight and lost. And we have every reason to believe that that's the way it is in John Boehner's perspective. Is his speakership in jeopardy at all?
It doesn't seem to be. You know, there are lots of comments that he's a weak speaker, but and I said that, in fact, on Wednesday with Dean, and then I said, well, but, you know, that may not be fair. It's just he's dealt a poor hand because, again, he's got all these folks who march to a different drummer, and there's not a lot he can do to discipline them. He's not as strong a speaker as Newt Gingrich was. However, he did what was perceived by some commentators, I think, as a certain weakness, just being carried along by the more extreme people in Congress, following in some ways Ted Cruz in the Senate. He seemed to be carried along by them, but a lot of them have read that as his giving him their chance. And he's getting credit from a lot of these folks for having given them their chance to make their arguments and express their anger and to fight back.
Mm-hmm. Another way I've heard that expressed is giving them plenty of rope, right?
Well, he certainly, I mean, he agrees with these folks,
right.
Not on tactics, but on goals. So I don't know if it's that he wanted to give them rope, but he certainly gave them the opportunity to try their strategy, and they've seen that they're at least some of them have seen that their strategy hasn't worked. But you've got Ted Cruz in the Senate saying, again, this would have worked if it weren't for establishment Republicans. You know, the people are sometimes called Republicrats by some Tea Party critics. They seem never to learn that those particular strategy won't work. You just have to try harder next time.
In John Boehner's defense, I heard Newt Gingrich making comments that Boehner has it much harder than he did in the mid-1990s. Didn't Gingrich had a Republican leader in the Senate, and Boehner has Reid to deal with. So that's a difference. And I think in one of the interviews with Gingrich, I think he said, you know, Bill Clinton was a president you could call up and talk to. And as you alluded to, President Obama has a different style.
Right. And style matters. I mean, it's not going to override ideological differences and policy differences, but it certainly can, to some extent, smooth the rough edges. On the other hand, again, with the rise of this alternative conservative media, you know, if you listen to Rush Limbaugh during the day or Sean Hannity at night and people like that, you know, their focus is on constantly pouring gasoline on the fire and exacerbating differences. So at some point, there's not a lot you can do with that, even if your style is great and you can schmooze a lot, as it were.
I have actually been listening to Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh to get those narratives. It's very interesting to see this open a divide in the Republican Party. Where do you see that divide going? Just staying where it is or widening?
Well, you know, the mainstream Republicans, and Republicans have always been a center-right party, they are more distinctly and homogeneously conservative than the Democrats are liberal. The Democrats have a wider range of policy views from moderate to liberal. Republicans are pretty uniformly conservative. Moderates just aren't as extreme in their methods. But I think that the Republican establishment, if you will, was accepting of the Tea Party wave in 2010. But even back then, I said, you know, when you ride the tiger, it's hard to get off. And a lot of them are turning against them by primarying, as the verb has become now, a lot of these Republicans. I mean, lately, Thad Cochran of Mississippi, who's nobody's moderate, let alone liberal, is now having to endure a challenge from the right. So Republicans have got to work out what they are. I mean, Democrats dealt with this in the early 70s in the aftermath of the McGovern years. But, you know, is it a political party that intends to govern, or is it a collection of political suicide bombers who simply look for martyrdom in the cause they serve? That's the fight that the Republicans, at least for right now, have to reconcile.
You mentioned the new verb, primarying.
Mm-hmm.
Dean Borg mentioned Tom Latham, the GOP yes vote for the deal in this state. And perhaps do you see him being challenged from the right?
I don't see anybody out there making any noise yet. I mean, Latham, of course, has always been very close to Boehner, as opposed to somebody like Steve King. You know, these things can happen. It just depends upon how people process that. But, you know, Latham's got a more complex district in terms of Polk County and substantial Democratic elements of the district, where Steve King, of course, has a much more conservative rural Republican district. So he knows what side of the coin he's on anyway, but it's easy for him to flip to that side because he's not going to get challenged in that regard, although there was some comment in Business Week about pro-business Republicans looking for a more business-friendly person to run against Steve King. That would be the really interesting thing that might happen.
That is interesting. In fact, I had the chance this week on Wednesday, as this deal was being struck, I was in Washington, D.C., and at the World War II monument, to spoke with Steve King.
I heard
there.
That, yeah.
Steve King there. And it's interesting that this does not, he will not relent. He's going forward. I don't think he doesn't see it as a lesson learned, does he?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, the standard view is we lost because we didn't stick to our guns. You know, these are the people. It's the mindset that goes back to 1964 with Barry Goldwater. In your heart, you know he's right. And some people would rather sail over the cliffs with flags flying than to compromise in any particular way. That's the danger to the political system, because politics is about compromise. And half a loaf has got to be seen as better than no loaf at all. But there are some people who are purists, and you have those on both sides of the aisle, more so on the Republican side now, who would rather sail over the cliff, principles unsullied.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of purists, you have to put in there freshman Texas Senator Ted Cruz, certainly making a name for himself in the past few weeks. I guess the question is, what kind of name, and does that name get attached to 2016 presidential contender?
Well, sure. I mean, he's gone way up in the estimation of Republicans that identify with the Tea Party. Now, the Republicans that are not Tea Party identifiers think much more unfavorably of him. You know, interestingly, Rand Paul is a different person in this mix. Paul is fairly quiet in all this. He let Cruz take the lead. Marco Rubio is trying to get back in the good graces of the Tea Party after what he initially said in the way of immigration. So he stuck more closely to Cruz. But Paul backed away a little bit. And at least in terms of solidifying your support among a certain intensely motivated and angry segment of the Republican Party, Ted Cruz certainly has done himself some good.
Let's look toward the future in the minute or two that we have left, Dennis Goldford. Okay, this is not solving. This is not the grand bargain that everybody's talked about in the past. It's a reprieve for a few months. How likely are we to see a repeat of this standoff in a few months when these agreements expire?
Well, you know, it feels as though, you know, when we react to this, it feels as though we've had 3 weeks of people hitting us in the head with a hammer, and now they've stopped, but the pain still lingers. Are they going to start hitting us in the head again? You know, you've got some firebrands on the Republican side who are willing to start this up again. It's a question of how well the leaders can tell that caucus, look, it didn't work last time. It wasn't just a matter of our not standing strong. It didn't work. So there's got to be some education of the firebrands on the part of the leadership, or we will end up doing something similar.
Well, Iowans will have a chance to meet one of the people figuring prominently in here. Ted Cruz, he will be on October 25th at the Ronald Reagan dinner in Des Moines, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And you'll see some strong support for him.
Okay. What will we be watching in the weeks to come to further determine the political fallout?
The extent to which non-Tea Party groups in the Republican Party really think it's time to draw a line and push back against the Tea Party. And, you know, if Republicans have been traditionally supporters of business has been very angry with this whole thing, because they thought their particular views have gone unheard and their interests have not been respected.
Mm-hmm.
Will they push back from their standpoint? On the other hand, that's one thing I'll look at. The other will be the question of whether, in fact, there are more primary challenges from the Tea Party right.
Dennis Goldford, thank you. It's not Wednesday, but we have the pleasure of having Dennis Goldford with us of Drake University, because we have an extra dose of Politics Day. We get an extra dose of Dennis. Thank you.
Great to talk to you, Ben.
Coming up in the second part of this News Buzz edition of our program, the World Food Prize controversy. I'll talk about it with Clay Masters. A welcome back for more Iowa National Guard troops and the capture of Willie the Pig. Marshmallows made the difference. A News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition of our program, quick hits on news that's been happening this week about Iowa and relevant to Iowa. The World Food Prize, commonly referred to as the Nobel Prize of Agriculture, awarded this week. And this year, 2013, it went to three biotechnology pioneers, and the ones they selected infuriated environmental groups. It went to Mary Dell Chilton, founder of Syngenta Biotechnology, Robert Fraley of Monsanto, and Mark Van Montague. He's the founder and chairman of the Institute of Plant Biotechnology Outreach. That's in Belgium. The three together helped introduce biotechnology into crop production. And we had them earlier this week on River to River. But let's check in with Clay Masters, who covered the award ceremony last night in Des Moines at the State House. Hi, Clay.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon to you. Tell us about the scene you found yesterday.
There were a lot of demonstrations throughout the week, various groups protesting genetically modified crops. And last night, a few dozen people, protesters, showed up on the west side of the Capitol and kind of in an Occupy Wall Street fashion did a mic check and started doing this call and response about Monsanto and big agriculture and its impact on smaller farms and how, you know, there's this big saying that goes on at the World Food Prize about feeding a growing population. 9 billion is the number that gets thrown around a lot. And these protesters throughout the week, their big claim is genetically modified organisms aren't the way to do that. That's not the way to feed the world.
Yeah, and they name a number of reasons for that. The risk of harm from GM food. These are their claims. The controversy over whether GM food should be labeled, the role of government regulators, the effect of GM crops on the environment, and the impact of these genetically modified crops on farmers in developing countries. So the those who were honored are saying, you know, this is 90% of the GMO crops are going to small, resource-poor farmers. And in the meantime, what is it, Clay? Some 17 million farmers grow these crops worldwide.
That's right. And you mentioned that this is seen as the Nobel Prize of Agriculture. And many of the protests were saying that this sends the wrong message to say that it's Monsanto and Syngenta scientists that are responsible for feeding the world. Claims that small farmers farming on small scales using agroecological practices that have been used for a long time are the ways to get off this cycle of using genetically modified crops. And, you know, there are some trait technologies that are being questioned. Take the BT technology. There's certain hybrid seeds that are made that are supposed to fight rootworms, so you can apply pesticides and you don't have to worry about killing the corn or the soybean. But in corn rootworm has basically found a chink in the armor, and this trait technology has failed. I was just reporting up in northeast Iowa last week, and a organic farmer brought me into a field of one of his neighbors who harvests genetically modified corn, and he showed me this whole swath of an area of corn plants that were just on their sides, and that's because corn rootworm is now able to take out these genetically modified traits, and that's traits had not failed up to a couple years ago.
Mm-hmm. Now, earlier this week when I had the three World Food Prize winners on, they were confronted actually on the program by people who were of a different opinion, and they showed some marked frustration, actually a disbelief that people just don't get it about GMOs. Let's listen back to a comment by Mary Dell Chilton.
I really don't understand the opposition to this technology. People say that it's not green, but it seems to me that, you know, the organic food should include genetically modified crops. I mean, it's a technology that, for one thing, reduces, and for another thing, in many cases, eliminates the need for some agricultural chemicals. So it reduces the impact of modern agriculture on the environment. And, you know, that can only be a good thing from my point of view.
That was Mary Dell Chilton from Syngenta Biotechnology. Clay, others also argue that there have not been any problems with this way of modifying crops.
And, you know, that's also a claim that Robert Fraley was making, too, that this technology's been on the marketplace for 20 years, and there's not a single incident of food or feed safety associated with the technology. So they see this really as a way to create more food to feed a hungry world.
So are there any indications, Clay, in the years to come that this controversy will be settled once and for all by science?
Well, I don't know if I see that yet in the crystal ball. There were a lot of things that were talked about at the World Food Prize, a variety of issues, but because of the award winners, genetically modified seeds continued to play a big part in the conversations. And you could really tell the controversy when in a press conference with former Prime Minister Tony Blair and philanthropist and farmer Howard Buffett, there was a reporter from Africa who talked about how some experts say the technology doesn't work, also talked about how Europe does not accept GMO products, and he asked the two why the technology is being pushed on Africa, and Tony Blair kind of let Howard Buffett take the questions, and then after Buffett was done speaking, he chuckled and said, "I agree with all of that." So, I don't see this getting wrapped up anytime soon.
Okay, thanks for wrapping up a week honoring the 2013 World Food Prize laureates, Clay Masters of Iowa Public Radio. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
It's a Friday News Buzz edition of the program, a chance for quick conversations with a variety of people about news stories this week or stories that we as Iowans are concerned with. And next up, three homecoming ceremonies for the 186th Military Police Company, Iowa Army National Guard, were held yesterday at the Des Moines International Airport. Joining us to talk about that welcome home and the deployment they were on, Colonel Hapgood, Iowa National Guard Public Affairs Officer. Colonel Hapgood, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Tell us some more details about who you welcomed home and the tours they returned from.
Yesterday, we had 40 members of the 186th Military Police Company that have spent the past year in Honduras came home. We typically do a single homecoming for a particular unit, but in this case, the unit wasn't large enough to have its own aircraft to bring them all home at once and had to fly home commercially. So we said, why not have three different homecomings when their flights arrive at the Des Moines Airport? And the airport folks were just incredibly gracious to help us accommodate that.
Tell us a little bit about their mission.
Well, the soldiers, as I said, spent the past year as part of what's called Joint Task Force Bravo, which is based in Honduras. As their military police officers, they have a lot of different jobs that they do from a security standpoint. One of those was base defense. The United States has an air base in Honduras that has strategic importance for North America. So they provided base defense there. But they also worked on projects to interdict drug trafficking, to catch transnational criminal elements down there. They did some humanitarian assistance nearby, and they also did some training with their counterparts at the Honduran security forces. So they had an extremely busy year.
Tell us a little bit, if we were going to see one of these homecomings, what happens? Because they can be quite moving experiences. These Iowa soldiers have been away from friends and family for a long time.
Well, it's not often in a person's life that you get to experience a moment of pure joy, but I would say that a homecoming is one of those rare events that, you know, you have people that have been in harm's way for typically somewhere 8 months to a year. They've been away from their families. They've been in a strange place, somewhat hostile. And the relief that they feel to be reunited with their family and loved ones and just to be back home in their communities is really a special moment. Typically, we have approximately 48 hours notice when it's absolutely locked in, the date and time that these units will come back. And we put out news releases. And, of course, the public is always invited, regardless of where they're held.
Mm-hmm. Now, give us an idea of where else in the world Iowa National Guard troops are at work still.
As of right now, we have approximately 100 soldiers in Afghanistan. The vast majority of those are members of the 833rd Engineer Company, which is based out of Ottumwa. They've spent nearly the past year in Afghanistan. Their primary focus during this tour has been to work on detecting improvised explosive devices and neutralizing those, or calling in assistance to help neutralize those. We anticipate seeing those soldiers home sometime in the next 30 to 60 days, depending on when they're released from active duty and get to come home.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we're always thinking about their well-being, especially when they were abroad. Any problems there, especially being in Afghanistan? Any injuries, losses?
Well, the unit has been remarkably fortunate during this tour. This is their third tour. They've been in Iraq previously, and they've done two tours in Afghanistan. They've been extremely fortunate that at this point they haven't had any serious injuries, and they have been extremely fortunate that their members are all safe. And, you know, they go out and do a job that's extremely dangerous every single day. They're very good at what they do, but it is a dangerous environment, to say the least.
those Iowans listening who want to be part of a welcome back ceremony, of course, missed the one yesterday with the 40 troops from returning from Honduras. But you said you get some notice in the next 30 to 60 days these 100 troops will be returning from Afghanistan. How can people find out more when you get notice so people interested in attending a welcome back might do so?
Well, as soon as we have the date and time locked down, we'll push out a news release that, you know, really will go to every media entity in the state of Iowa that we have contact information for. Additionally, we also post on our website, which is iowanationalguard.com. And additionally, we also put lots of information on our Facebook page as well. So there's lots of places where it can be found. And we're hopeful that as many people that would like to come are able to do so.
Colonel Hapgood, because this week we saw the end of the partial government shutdown, I know that affected the Iowa National Guard. What does that mean for you?
Well, this week with the restart of the government, it's been very fortunate for us that we've now been able to bring back all of our full-time employees that were either temporarily laid off or furloughed. We're now able to purchase things again, which is extremely important to, you know, keep our vehicles running, to make sure we have plenty of supplies, those kinds of things. But also we can reinstitute training. We had to cancel training for the first 3 weeks of October because of the shutdown, and now we're able to, again, pay soldiers and airmen to train, to be able to provide meals or other things that they might need during the course of that training. So we're extremely pleased that a deal could be reached and the shutdown is over.
Past that catch-up that you've just described, is there any long-term damage or things you have to deal with once you get caught up here?
Well, the one complication, because of the timing of the shutdown in October, October is a significant training month for the vast majority of our units that do certain training once a year. For instance, your annual physical fitness testing is often done in October because that's the first training month of the new training year, which starts October 1st. So we're working to implement a plan to squeeze in that training that was missed in October throughout the rest of the year so we can get where we need to be. In the short term, it complicates things, but we believe in the long term this year we'll end up fine.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us for a few minutes. Colonel Greg Hapgood of the Iowa National Guard, we appreciate it.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
News Buzz edition of our program here on River to River, winding up the hour. And finally today, turns out marshmallows made the difference. In a Des Moines neighborhood, Willie, the pot-bellied pig, has been on the loose since June. That was until this week. Joining us to talk about Willie's capture, the Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. Welcome back to Kyle Munson on our program. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, Ben.
This is a nice story that we've been following all most of the summer. It turns out that Willie had a sweet tooth. Tell us about the capture.
Yeah, it's funny, you know, so it's the week of the World Food Prize in the state capital. I end up chasing the story of one ham on the lamb, I guess, so to speak. But, yeah, you know, it's pot-bellied pigs have become a more popular pet everywhere, and so that leads to the same problems that, you know, dogs and cats have. They become like an animal control issue occasionally. So Willie was this stubborn pot-bellied pig that had been rooting up yards, in this East Des Moines neighborhood. So animal control finally got involved several weeks ago. They put a cage in this particular backyard where Willie liked to dash into the creek. And but she eluded capture for a long time. Finally, after you can almost picture this, there were three animal control officers with a couple of nets out there trying to catch her to no avail.
Sounds like better than a Laurel and Hardy flick to me.
Exactly, yeah. Just think of just a classic Laurel and Hardy, Benny Hill, whatever. And so finally, you know, the animal control officer says, all right, put a bag of marshmallows in there. So that's what did the trick. The next morning, she was spotted in the cage. They came and nabbed her, and Willie was finally safely behind bars. And she's in a five-day purgatory in which the owner could come and claim her. Otherwise, she'll be put up for adoption.
What do we know about where she came from? You said this was perhaps a pet at one time?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of I never know what I'm going to be writing about as a columnist as I roam around the state. And part of what attracted me to this is just this lore had built up in this neighborhood about what are this pig's origins and what is it actually capable of? Where's it from? There was one neighbor that spotted this slender young man at one point who did come and throw a tarp over the pig and supposedly walked away with it as it was squealing and was calling it Willie, and that's where the name came from. This one neighbor saw this alleged owner that said, Willie, Willie, come on. And so that's where people seem to think that there was an owner. It was named Willie. But who knows? But that was the only sighting. There's been nobody that has stepped forward yet since then. So this pig, you know, for weeks, you know, since June, when, you know, the neighbors say this pig has been wandering this neighborhood, so they thought it lived nearby, but nobody's been located. People went door to door looking for the neighbor, looking for the owner. No luck. So we don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. I'll mention there's a video of Willie on the Des Moines Register website with your column there. Quite a sweet looking animal. I have to believe someone's going to want to adopt her.
Yeah, I talked to a local veterinary clinic near the neighborhood, and they have quite a few pot-bellied pig clients. There was another owner of a pot-bellied pig who lived nearby that is similar coloring to Willie, but you know, assured me that's not their pig. And so, yeah, like I say, they become popular, and apparently this one has enjoyed a free roaming summer and quite a diet of table scraps. I mean, she was being fed apples and all, you know, meats and you know, all kinds of stuff. So
now, Kyle, I know you have a couple of offspring to look after, but maybe your family would love to have Willie, in addition to feed table scraps to.
Yeah, I have an old collie mix dog who's great, and I have a borderline psychotic cat, so I think I'm okay. So.
Now, on a related topic to finish up here, Kyle, now this is something that Willie's going to have to turn off the radio because we're going to talk about it, and Willie will surely not approve. Next week at the Iowa State Center in Ames, I understand it's the university's inaugural Bacon Expo, October.
Yeah.
October, no, that's actually tomorrow, isn't
tomorrow.
It? Tomorrow.
Yeah.
What can you tell us about that? Have you been following?
Well, I mean, all things bacon, I mean, it's just, you know, we're in the best state in the world for this, of course. So the Blue Ribbon Bacon Festival in Des Moines in recent years has just escalated and become something that now is, just this week we learned that it's included in the latest Ripley's Believe It or Not. An Iowa State senior has started an Iowa State version of a bacon festival, and they expect some, you know, 1,200 people to attend the Iowa State Center. I mean, you know, I can remember the days when it used to be Aerosmith and Kiss and arena rock shows. You know, that's what attracted people to the Iowa State Center. Now all you need is a giant pile of bacon, and people just flood through the doors. So
now I'm reading in some information about this from the Ames Tribune. A bacon eating contest.
Mm-hmm.
You had to figure with that, right? But also unusual food with bacon in it. I'm trying to think if I've had any unusual. I like it just straight up. You know, the best way to eat bacon, in my opinion, is with some pancakes and plenty of maple syrup. It's that sweet and salty thing going together that's pretty pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm with you on that. Actually, at the state Iowa State Fair this year, I helped judge the inaugural pork and corn heaven contest. So it was all these creations with corn and pork, and a lot of them featured bacon. I had this bacon ice cream that was so sweet, I think I instantly got diabetes. But you know, I tasted a lot of bacon varieties in that thing, and I was quite amazed that the ice cream still sticks with my memory.
Any word if there will be a Miss Bacon pageant?
You know, I have not heard that as part of the coverage.
Well,
that would be interesting. Yeah, like a Bacon Queen, King and Queen contest or something.
Right. There could be a rivalry in the making here between this new festival and the Blue Ribbon Bacon Festival held in Des Moines. You know, there could be a sizzling rivalry.
I think we nice. I think there's a good connection there between Des Moines and Ames. But you think about, you know, Iowa State and University of Iowa and the Cyhawks football showdown. We could foresee like a bacon festival Cyhawk game of sorts. Maybe that could become something.
Right. All right. We have to keep that cliche thinking about Iowa going on. So this will add to that. Have to enforce it. I understand the organizers of the world's largest bacon showcase in Des Moines, that Blue Ribbon Bacon Festival. Last time they sold out of 8,000 tickets for this year's festival in about 3 minutes, Kyle.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And they've gone
that's,
global.
That's, that shows you got a good brand, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, they've been over. I think it's to Iceland. I mean, they've taken. I mean, they've been exporting this concept around the world now, okay. And it's bacon has just become more and more popular.
Well, Kyle, thank you for joining us. Kyle Munson, the Iowa columnist for the Des Moines Register. Thank you for bringing us up. We've got a little music in tribute to Willie, even though she is in captivity. You know what's coming. Thanks, Kyle, for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. It's always fun. Take care.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. It's a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend.
Silly with a smile, shine, shimmy, shuffle, smile.